This is Sarah Reith with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll hear from George Montag, who was born in Hungary and came to the United States when he was 7 years old. He came to the Bay Area from New York for the Summer of Love, then settled in Elk in 1971. We spoke last summer in a little room in the Greenwood School with the smell of eucalyptus trees and the ocean wafting past the door. I was late because a cloud of butterflies had risen up out of the forest along the Greenwood Philo Road.
I've been living here since late 1971. I spent a couple of years in the Bay Area. Before that, I was in New York. I started out in Hungary, born in Hungary, and moved to the United States when I was 7. I was one of the first people in my group to go to California. I went out to San Francisco for the Summer of Love in 67 because I had to go and see it for myself. You know, I'd heard about it. And so I was there in the summer of 67, ended up back in New York and was going to go back to school, but I didn't. I moved back to California later in 67 and had a girlfriend then. And by 1969, we had a child, we were married, and we were living in New York because somehow she had wanted to go back to New York, and we got bogged down there for almost 2 years and had a kid and all this stuff. And then we just had to get out of New York. And so at the end of 69, I moved to the Bay Area, where all my friends had moved after I told them about California. All my good friends were living in Berkeley. And so I ended up there, and then I was in Berkeley just kind of doing not much. And meanwhile, all my friends had moved to Mendocino County. And so I came up here, and my friends were mostly living in Albion. And I went and stayed with them a little while, and a house came up for rent in Elk, and I rented it with this other person, just a person that, you know, that we shared the house. And I was living in town. So I moved in here in 1971. I moved into Elk with a beautiful view of the cove and everything right there on the corner of Greenwood Road. It was a very nice place. And then about 2 years later, some friends of mine had bought some property up the road, and they wanted more people to live on their property, so they invited us and another couple to go live up there, and I've been there ever since.
So was this like a communal living environment or an intentional community?
Yeah, it was a little bit of whatever. It wasn't really communal. There was one little hunting cabin on the property that him and his girlfriend were living in. And then I was starting to build a house, and we bought a 45-foot by 8-foot trailer that we lived in while I started to build my house. And we did, you know, we shared a water system and the road, and we didn't share that much else, but it's a tenants in common land use. You know, we have a land use agreement and all this kind of stuff, but it wasn't a communal situation, no.
So what were your expectations when you first arrived?
I was so young. I was a single father already. My wife and I had split up when I came to Elk. It was just my son, who was 2, and myself. And we schlepped up here. And I just wanted to be in the country. I wanted to grow things. I grew up in New York City, and while it's wonderful in New York City, I couldn't live there anymore. And I just wanted to, you know, live a peaceful, old-fashioned kind of lifestyle. Back to the land wasn't like a defined thing back then, you know. If it had been, that's what I would have wanted to do, but we didn't know. Yeah, I didn't really realize that's what we were doing, but that's what we were doing.
What were some of your first impressions?
Well, it's obviously beautiful here. And there was already kind of a scene of people my age that thought similarly to myself. And it just seemed friendly. And Elk especially was a very laissez-faire town. The old-timers did not have any antagonism towards the newcomers, as long as you didn't try to push your ideas on them too hard. and they didn't try to push their ideas on you. It was a live and let live situation, much more so, in my opinion, than the other small towns up and down the coast. There were just not that many old-timers left, and maybe they were just mellower than the average run of old-timers, but everybody seemed to get along just really nicely. And so it just seemed ideal. You know, I planted my first garden because I'd lived in cities all my life and had a little side yard, planted a garden. Something I'd always wanted to do, and so I got to do it. And I just said, I'm just going to stay here and have this kind of nice outdoor country life.
Do you have any memories of specific interactions with folks who are here, either the old timers or the folks who are living on the property that were tenants in common?
Well, first I was in town, and there were, the newcomers had started a little Sunday soccer game that we played in this rock-strewn field in the middle of town, and some of the older, the young old-timers that were more our age were playing soccer with us, so we got to meet everybody, and they seemed like a friendly sort. You know, they maybe drank more than the newcomers, I guess everybody was like smoking pot, so we had that in common, and got along, and man that owned the garage, Mel, kind of shepherded you along into helping you with your plumbing or whatever else you needed help with that you obviously, coming from the city, knew nothing about. The first year I was here, there was a big freeze and all the pipes froze, and so we needed help. Everybody needed a lot of help, and you got your car fixed at the garage, and you get some free advice, and his brother owned the store, so the two brothers owned the two big thriving enterprises in town, the store and the garage. And we just got along well with all these people right from the beginning. And then I met these guy that found our land, had come back from being in the merchant marine in Vietnam, and he had retired out of that, and he looking for a piece of land, went down our driveway. I live about 2.5 miles up Greenwood Road. And it was May. The rhododendrons were in bloom. For sale, he bought the property. And then he said, I need more people to live here and help me make some of the payments. And that's how we ended up there. And in the beginning, we just did our thing. He did his thing, and then there was another couple that were also living there. So it was three couples. And we got along well, at least at the beginning. Though those situations, in my experience and almost everybody else's, those situations tend to deteriorate over time, as ours did.
So I'll ask you at one point what went wrong, but for now, you just mentioned that you were building your house and planting a garden. Can you describe what that process was like? Building your house, it sounds like you didn't have a lot of knowledge about how to do that going in.
Had no knowledge. I had high hopes. I was going to do everything by hand. We didn't have electricity or anything. We didn't have a drivable driveway in the winter. It's 3/4 of a mile down to where my house is off the road. And we were like wheelbarrowing laundry up the driveway to where we could park a car. And I was living in that trailer and building house by hand, and I had this crazy idea that I wanted to build this hexagonal house, and I wanted to do this fancy notching and all this kind of stuff. And I probably wouldn't have listened to anybody who tried to talk me out of it anyway, because we just were doing what we were doing as best we could. And I, a lot of hand sawing. I didn't have any power tools or anything. And spent a couple of years building this thing while living in the trailer. And then by that time, I was not ready to move in, but felt like we needed to move in. We had a child, Donna and I, who I met in Elk. Okay, so maybe I should get back there. I met my wife in Elk. She came here with Cat Mother, which was this rock group that moved to Elk. She knew them, and she ended up in Elk and took over this little nursery school. And meanwhile, I had gotten a job figuring out that the way to get work here was the only people that seemed to have money were people that could afford to go to the bar. So I'd go to the bar in the afternoon and meet these loggers who were coming off work and getting a drink. And eventually one of them gave me a job. And so that was my first job up here. So then my wife was running the nursery school, or my present wife, and so she met my kid before she met me, because once I had a job, I needed childcare.
What was the job that you're doing?
I was a choker setter in a bulldozer logging operation. A choker setter puts the cable around the log and then hooks it up to a hook on a bulldozer, and they haul it out of there. Really hard work. At the then relatively decent wage of $3 an hour. That was more than we were living on, was a $3 an hour job. It was amazing. We could save some money out of that. And then eventually I got a job with a really good logger, and I was making $5 an hour and working 60 hours a week, and he paid overtime because he was an honorable guy. And so I was really saving money then and living on unemployment for, whenever, the entire rainy season. Did that for 3 years, decided I had enough money to start building a house, and started scrounging and buying materials, and went from there.
Can you describe the house that you eventually built?
Okay, so it's a hexagonal house. It's about 16 feet on a side. It's 2 stories tall. It's sort of my own variation on timber framing. It's post and beam construction. I notched the posts into the beams with these dovetail joints, and I was trying to do it all without nails, or at least the framing. I was drilling holes and pinning it with 3/4-inch dowels in through the framing, and it was a much slower process than I thought. In fact, I thought I was going to find logs around the property and mill all the lumber myself with an Alaskan mill. I spent the whole summer milling 8x8s, which got me enough 8x8s to get from the foundation up to the first floor level. So then it was, okay, time to get some work and save money and buy lumber, because that wasn't going to work. But so it's, and I designed the walls around the windows that I was able to buy, used windows that I bought cheaply. And the whole idea of a hexagon was, bees, hives are hexagonal. They're really stable. That's a great thing. We'll just build a hexagonal house, and we'll do all this framing with these dovetails, because that's going to look really cool. And again, nobody talked me out of it, and I probably wouldn't have listened anyway.
You said earlier that you were interested in insects. So it sounds like your interests in insects kind of contributed to how you built your house.
Well, yeah, well, I was always interested in the things that were around here. I had an interest in plants. Ants and plants, as my sixth grade teacher once told me. That's what I seemed to be interested in New York. And, I'm always interested in the flora and fauna around me. And I like insects and snakes and stuff, a little more than the average person probably.
What were you studying were you studying when, academically, before you came here?
I didn't have a clue as to what I was going to do. I was going to major in, who knows, math at first, and then I flunked out of my first math class, and then it was going to be philosophy, because, you didn't have to know anything to major in philosophy. But I dropped out at a very early part of I took a leave of absence in my first year and took a job, and then I went to Haight-Ashbury. And when I went back to re-register, it just seemed way too, after Haight-Ashbury, it just seemed way too hectic and too not in keeping with what I wanted to do with my life. And I just continued my leave of absence. I think they're still waiting for me to come back. I don't think I'm going to make it. But it was more the growing stuff. I just was really interested in having a garden. That's one of the first things we did, was clear a space for a garden in the midst of the redwoods. Not realizing that the north slope wasn't that conducive to gardening as much as if I had ended up in a different place. But we're making it work.
Talk about your gardening and how you figured out, or how you created food for yourself.
Started reading organic gardening magazine, tried to follow the tenets of organic gardening. And, you know, we got some advice from some of the old timers that were into gardening. Most of them weren't really that big into it, but a few of them were. And we got advice from them. And we talked to people. We read stuff. And you grew, you know, the stuff that either you wanted to grow or the stuff that you were told did well around here. So it would be, you know, you wanted to grow corn because fresh corn is really good. Tomatoes, peppers. And you grew all the stuff that, and some of it worked, some of it didn't. The stuff that worked, you grew more of. Stuff that didn't work, you kept trying anyway until until you came to your senses. And eventually, you know, those of us that kept at it, like I've continuously had a garden. And looks really great out there right now. I'm still doing it, and I'm still enjoying being in my garden for hours every day. So I guess I got what I wanted out of life on that. And along the way, I tried a little semi-commercial market gardening, which was fun and a lot of work and made very little money. I found out that farming is different than gardening, any sort of farming. So, but the actual growing stuff is still a joy and a pleasure.
What about animals? Did you have goats or chickens or any kind of livestock?
Yeah, so that was part of the whole thing then. So I wanted to get chickens. Once I had chickens, I wanted to have ducks. And I had a couple of geese for a few years. And then somebody here had rabbits, and that seemed like a really good idea. And so I was raising rabbits for a long time. And it was mostly with the kids, and it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of, I didn't have dogs, but early on I had a couple of dogs that didn't go so well. They chased sheep when there were still a lot of sheep around here. Got in trouble with the animal control. They took my dog. Sad story, never got another dog. But had cats. I had the chickens and ducks and rabbits for, I'm guessing 15 years or so before. When the kids moved away, I started doing other stuff and didn't want to be tied down to the animals so much. It's hard enough getting somebody to come and water your garden when you're gone. But taking care of your animals and keeping them from getting eaten by raccoons and bobcats is another story.
Did you ever have any memorable encounters with wildlife when you're out here?
You see the occasional bear that'll come and crush your garden fence trying to come in there for reasons unknown. In my case, it was to get at the bone meal that was in a garbage can for fertilizer. The bear smelled it, thought it was something good to eat. And you come out and, you know, your corn would be all gone, and you'd come out at night and there was the raccoons just tearing the ears of corn off the plant just before they were ripe enough for you to pick. Or all your fruit would be gone with the raccoons. Mostly it was raccoons and whatever other predators are coming around at night in your garden. You know, skunks, raccoons, possums. And you eventually learn that, okay, they're going to get some of it, but I'll get most of it, and that's okay. I wasn't big on killing things if I didn't have to kill anything.
So do you have any memories of special gatherings or get-togethers or any kind of annual events that happened in the community?
As you may or may not know, we have the annual Great Day in Elk Festival, which, you know, of course, it's always a great day in Elk. That's the kind of joke of it. And so that started about 45 years ago, and I've been to every one from the very beginning. And it was originally going to be this fun day, and the kids would have these games, and we'd raise some money to help build the community center. That was the original idea. And now it's the only fundraiser that the community center actually needs to hold. We raise all the money to keep that thing running in one day every year. So that's been kind of really a great thing. And so I volunteered at one thing or another every year for all those years. I ran the greased pole, $100 bill at the top of a greased pole, that an attractive nuisance to keep people interested in being there. I bake a cake for the cake auction every year. The cakes sell for hundreds and hundreds of dollars, as much as $1,000, though, you know, usually they top out at $500 or $600. Because there's you know, $2,000 out there for cakes every year in whatever configuration. So if you have 8 cakes, they sell for a lot. If you have 12 cakes, they sell for a little less. But that's how much money is out there. And that's something that everybody in the community comes together and centers their that part of their summer around. And it's actually continued to thrive. We've actually gotten some younger people to start taking that over. For a while, we worried. You know, we did this stuff in our 20s, and then we were doing it in our 30s, and we were doing it in our 40s, and then we were doing it in our 50s, and then we began to wonder, where are the young people in their 20s and 30s that are going to come along and take this over? But it's finally starting to happen. The young people are taking over all these roles that all of us have been doing for 40 years.
Can you describe the first Great Day in Elk?
Yes, and you should probably get a hold of the little video clip that there is of that video. It was an actual 16-millimeter movie at the time. There was a guy that ended up in Hollywood that was taking movies. We had these games for the kids. So you had like a three-legged race. You had a sack race. You had egg-tossing contest. You had watermelon eating contests. You had all these games for kids to play, you know, throwing darts at balloons, but they were set up so that all the kids won lots of prizes rather than the way that it is when you go to the fair and nobody wins anything of value. And we had lots of food things set up. I mean, for years I ran the sausage making booth, and then there's a dinner afterwards, and off and on there's been dances. But the first one was just everybody getting together and setting up these booths and just, you know, your home, working on your own homestead all the time. This is a chance to get together with everybody in the community and have a nice time with them. And it was so popular that we've continued it every year. And, you know, not a year has been missed. Though we have occasionally talked about, well, if all the people have to work on this, just threw in $100 a piece, we wouldn't have to do any work. It probably raised just as much money, but that wouldn't be fun. So we've decided to keep it all fun.
You just mentioned that everybody is always at work homesteading. What's the toughest thing about homesteading?
Cut and split hundreds of cords of firewood. Firewood is, though, you know, very satisfying, but hard work. Keeping your garden going. In the early days, we'd go down to the dairy and slop out the calf barn to get the fertilizer, you know, so-called free fertilizer, though it would seem like, it was, looking back on it, very hard work for the free fertilizer. I remember in the early days, because the soil was so poor where we lived, that I had to, like, constantly be trying to make more compost to try to enrich the soil and constantly searching for stuff to bring home. And then you plant fruit trees, so you have to keep the fruit trees pruned, and you have to keep you have to pick all the stuff. And then when you pick all the stuff, you have to deal with all the stuff. So it seemed like there was a never-ending supply of chores that needed to be done for all of us. And yet we still had time to go to the river a couple of times a week during the summer and, you know, still have fun activities. There might have been more hours in a day back then than there are today. That's the only explanation.
Do you have any particular memories that are especially emblematic of that time for you?
It all blends together to some extent. You know, we had community center meetings and people would get together. We elected a community center board. We started a volunteer ambulance service because there was no ambulance in town. The fire department was almost completely non-existent and got that thing going. So there's been a volunteer fire department. I was on the ambulance for a number of years. It was hard for me to get calls. I lived so far in the woods and no phone. You know, you couldn't depend on the phone. For a number of years, I didn't have a phone. And so it was hard to get paged out. But we did that, and we did all our training, the CPR training. It was a very do-it-yourself kind of thing. We made our own community, which was many of us coming from cities and other places. It didn't seem to have much community, even though there were many, many people. That was something that I think we were all hungry for, a feeling of community. And we were able to create our own community, including the community center, but in general, the the community of Elk, there's the coastal community, I'm a member of the Jewish community. We had to create that out of nothing also, because we were looking for something, some kind of spiritual path, so we could pass it on to our kids, or at least that was my motivation. I wasn't particularly religious when I was brought up, but I wanted to have my kids to be able to have a Jewish experience or some kind of spiritual experience. And that was the one that I was at home with. I didn't want to do the Native American thing or like the Buddhist thing, because I knew nothing about that. So I went with what I knew to some extent.
Can you talk a little bit about what it took to create a Jewish community out here?
Well, originally it was for Jewish people, the High Holy Days, the most important things on the calendar, the High Holy Days, which come in the fall, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And that was something that even if you were barely religious or not religious at all, or even atheist or agnostic Jew, you still wanted to do the High Holy Days. And the other thing was Passover, the Passover Seder, which I really don't know anybody that doesn't remember that fondly. Whatever form it took in your family, it's something you remember very fondly. So we wanted to have that. And that just led to, well, we're doing this. And then we had to rent buildings and find somebody that could officiate and find a rabbi. And it just kind of organically grew until we actually incorporated as a community. And that thing's quite ongoing. We bought an old church that's our shul in Casper. That's now, I think we've had it about 20 years now. Before that, we were at the mercy of whatever we could rent from either other organizations or, in one case, the top floor of a house in Mendocino.
So what was the first holiday that you celebrated as the Jewish community?
Probably the very first one I remember is there was a community Seder for Passover, which wasn't particularly Jewish, but it was very community. Passover is a holiday where you don't eat any leavened products or products that could be leavened. But it was a potluck, so people bought muffins. they didn't quite get the concept, because it was open to anybody who wanted to come. And so it was definitely a feeling of community that brought people together. And then the people that felt like they had more knowledge or they wanted something a little more traditional just got together and talked about it, and we just kind of made it happen. And then the next year we started trying to get people to come up here to officiate for High Holy Days. That's the one time you can do a Seder as just a family thing, but for High Holy Days you really feel like you need a rabbi or somebody who's at least knowledgeable enough to pass for a rabbi.
What was the most memorable holiday celebration?
Really hard. I've been to so many of them at this point. Well, when we got our own, we actually hired a rabbi. We got a big enough community with enough members to actually get a full-time rabbi eventually. So, the first experiences with our own rabbi. And then eventually in our own building is probably the most memorable part of it. So we've had a lot of events over the years, including fundraisers and film things and food, food events, all kinds of different events that we've managed to put together over the years. We celebrate a lot of them as parties. There's a big Hanukkah party, there's a big Purim party. So they're not necessarily just hanging out and praying like you would for the High Holy Days. And there's an ongoing Saturday morning service that's kind of like an important thing. We also have our own Chevra Kedisha, which is a burial society, because we were told by a wise scholar one time that's one of the first things you have to set up is a burial society so people can have a proper Jewish burial. So we did that. Doing my first Tahara, which is like this ritual of washing the body, that was kind of a big thing for me. I didn't know. And it's an awesome kind of thing. You're kind of in touch. Death is just as important as birth in many ways. So It gets you in touch with the ineffability of life.
So let's go back to the tenants in common. Like, how did you organize that? It sounds like kind of a microcosm of a community. How did you figure out who was supposed to do what and make sure that it happened?
Yeah, well, we had a lot of land meetings where we organized ourselves according to certain rules, like which areas would you controlled completely around your house, and what was like a communal use area where anybody could cut firewood or do whatever it is that they wanted, which turned out to be not much of anything else. It's all trees. You know, we live on 56 acres, most of which is just in timberland, and so wasn't that much more. But, you know, so we kept the water system up together, and we keep the road up together. And we had a lot of meetings on, you know, how we were going to resolve disputes in the future. And that was a very interesting process, which I would not care to repeat. It was very tedious and very hard on all of us, I think. Once we got done and hammered out this actual contract and land use agreement, I don't think we ever had another meeting for about 20 years.
Did it all have to be by consensus?
We had different form because we had one partner that was the majority owner, so we had all these different ways of voting on different things, you know, so-and-so and three other tenants and a couple of things, like to expel somebody needed to be unanimous, this kind of stuff. So we worked out these rules, which most of them have never been tested to see how well they'd work.
And you hinted at the beginning that that it kind of fell apart. What went wrong?
People just, their lives are different. You know, the one couple who was a main partner, him and his partner split up, and they both ended up moving away, and just even then, they just had a different idea of what they wanted out of life than we did. So basically, we just left each other alone. It was kind of three separate homesteads after a while. And every once in a while, there'd be like some kind of dispute, which would arise, and then we'd try to settle it as best we could. And then eventually, the two couples that liked it here the most, we'd been here continuously, and we get along fine. And then the other partner, they didn't live here, and they rented the house out. And at one point, the house burned down while the tenants were living in it. So it was kind of, things happen. Things just happen. We weren't as close after a while as we were before. And it's kind of, you know, friends come and go sometimes in life. Sometimes they're friends for life and sometimes they're not. But your partner's there forever.
You said that your wife helped found the nursery school. Is that the school that we're sitting in right now?
No, this is there's been many reincarnations of nursery schools and preschool around here. No, it was just in a little tiny house down in town, which is now part of one of the cabins for a bed and breakfast. And this one woman had started it that moved here with I think she moved here with the band originally. And then she had to leave because she was, she was British, and she had to go either go back to England, get her visa renewed, or marry an American. I forget what she ended up doing, but she left, and my wife and this other woman took over the nursery school and the house that it was in as a place to live. And so I had just gotten this job and working in the woods, and my son needed daycare. I think I had had a girlfriend at that point. She was not interested in caring for my child, and she was not interested in hanging around very long. I think she had left by then. So my kid was in daycare. So I met the nursery school teacher and got along. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So what about the rest of educating your kids? Did you do any kind of alternative homeschooling or public school? How did that go for you?
Okay, so we are sitting where my kids went to school. My son went here from kindergarten through sixth grade in basically a one-room school. And my daughter went from kindergarten through fifth grade. She's like 7 years younger. The sixth grade had been sent off to Mendocino by that time. We knew the teachers, we knew everybody, and it was economically feasible because of the way public education is financed in California. For a school with only sometimes as few as 10 or 11 kids in it to be financially viable. That's another story on school finance. We'll do that someday. And, you know, we were hands-on parents, but I personally didn't want to do homeschooling. Some people did. Some people were really wild about homeschooling. When you live in the woods and your kid hardly ever sees any people unless you make a point of getting them to somebody else's house or having somebody come down to your house, you want to have that socializing, the socialization and interaction with other kids. So school was like a great thing. The kids loved going to school. They just loved getting out of the house and being with other kids. So that worked great.
Were you able to teach your kids any of the homesteading skills that you picked up?
What you can teach them if they want to learn. I got a lot of work out of my son when he was little. I had him stacking firewood and, you know, weeding the garden and doing all that stuff. But didn't seem like that was his real life interest, you know, as it turns out. None of that stuff captivated him that much. He wanted to play baseball. And so, you know, he set up his own pitchback and a place to practice throwing strikes, and he had a couple of buddies that were also into baseball, and they just spent a lot of afternoons playing baseball, preparing themselves to be major league ball players. It didn't happen. But they were prepared in case it was going to happen. And they, you know, they know country skills up to a point just because they had to. I mean, I had an outhouse for years. I had propane lights. I'm still off the grid. I have, you know, solar panels and that kind of stuff for whatever electricity I have. But I didn't even have any of that for a long time. It was a really off the grid, kind of a 19th century lifestyle.
So what's your lifestyle like now?
Late 19th century. With computer and TV, you know, satellite dish, satellite computer access, and solar panels and battery bank and an inverter for, you know, whatever amount of electricity. But it's a different lifestyle than what they're living in the city. I'm not really into social media. I'm not, you know, I don't text. I mean, I'm not quite a Luddite, but I verge and lean in that direction, let's say. And I'm content living an old-fashioned lifestyle. So I guess what I originally envisioned as doing, that's what I ended up doing, which is kind of cool.
So when you reflect on when you first came here, what do you think has changed the most?
Well, it's certainly a way more touristy area. You know, when I first got here, the Mendocino Hotel was this funky, run-down hotel. And now it's like this fancy emporium of richness and overblown taste. Now, it's become much more tourist-oriented. It was still, like, even Mendocino itself was still a town where families actually lived right in town, and people knew each other up and down the coast. Of course, the old timers, oh, when you guys came, you know, it's all different. Before, you'd go up and down the coast and you'd know every car. You'd wave to them and you'd know exactly who was in every car. Probably an exaggeration, but still. But there's definitely less and less, you know fewer and fewer people, even though you've been here longer. Of course, part of that is age. People either pass away or move away in some cases. But the 21st century has made it to Mendocino now, which I'm not sure that I ever thought it would. It's almost made it to Elk. Not quite in Elk. It's hardly a new building in town since I've been here. The present has encroached too much on the past as of yet.
How do you think the Back to the Land movement changed the culture of Mendocino County?
Well, I mean, part of it is we're really getting the fruits of it now with the whole cannabis thing. All of us, not all of us, but many of us Back to the Land hippies wanted to grow at least a few plants for our own use of growing some pot. And then, of course, there was the financial aspect. Well, hell, there's a little more than I can use. Maybe I could sell it to my friends in the city and that kind of stuff. But I think a lot of us had a real consciousness of the earth and wanting to be at one with the earth and trying to not harm the land and live in harmony with our surroundings. And I think that that's become part of the ethos of this area, especially along the coast, maybe less so inland in Mendocino. I'm not really sure. I just don't go inland all that much. If you're leaving the coast, you tend to want to go to Santa Rosa or San Francisco, or at least I do. Don't make too many trips to Ukiah just for having fun, even though I'm sure you can have a lot of fun in Ukiah. But I think that that spirit that we brought here of trying to create community has actually led to the creation of a lot of community, that people care about each other. There's a spirit of volunteerism here that is probably unmatched by many areas. In other areas, people give money, and that's considered some sort of volunteerism. But here is a lot of hands-on volunteerism that's gone on over the years. You know, when I decided I couldn't be on the ambulance anymore, I said, okay, so what am I going to do? So I ran for the school board, and I was on the school board for 12 years and tried to move public education into the direction that I thought it should go, which is, you know, more caring and more humanistic kind of education and less teaching to the test. Though how much you can influence that even as a school board member leaves a lot to be desired. You know, there are so many rules and regulations around stuff, but you try to work around the stuff and try to get things changed as much as you can. So I feel like we've influenced things positively, those of us that came around.
Do you feel like you were able to pass those values down to the next generation?
I'm very proud of the next generation, not necessarily my kids, though I am proud of my kids also, but I was just thinking on the way down, kids around here are like getting degrees and PhDs, and and very few of them want to become high-priced lawyers or high-priced doctors. They, you know, if they go into law, they want to go into public law. They're getting PhDs in environmental engineering and that, you know, those kind of topics. So I think that the kids really have picked up the values of the back to the land people way more than they would have in other places. I really think, if anything, the kids come out of the local school systems with a little too much self-confidence, which is exactly the opposite of what was going on when I was a kid. You graduate high school, you'd be beaten down by that time. But here, people are just hopeful and ready to speak their minds and feel like that their voice is important. Kind of like those Parkland kids. I feel like those kids could fit in, or if something like that happened here, that's the kind of reaction there would be here, rather than the let's arm the teacher, rather than that mentality that's prevalent in a lot of the country. But I don't know if somebody could come up here as like a single father with a kid with one sleeping bag, one broken down car, and two cardboard boxes that held all our belongings and be able to make it. I don't know how it's possible with rents and the cost of living having gone up so incredibly high over the years. And I'm not sure that even though we have younger people, I'm not sure the community is as welcoming as it was back then. I do worry about that. But I was worried about like no young people taking over the institutions that we created. And they're taking them over now. You know, there's young people running the Great Dane Elk. It took 30 years before they really started engaging them. So hopefully young people are taking over and are going to want to stay, even though they're not going to get rich if they stay here.
So what do you think made it possible for you to come here as a young father with so little and just make it happen?
Probably ignorance helped. I didn't know any better. And yet, but I had a sense that it could, I just had an optimistic sense that that this could work, that this was the right place. You know, I got the elk and it was just, wow, this is so nice. I don't think I'm ever going to leave, and I never have. You know, we were willing to work hard, and we wanted to play hard, and we wanted to make friends and do these country things and enjoy them. And for the most part, those of us that came here and stayed did. You know, we entered stuff in the county fair. We participated in these old-timey activities. Some we liked, some we didn't. You know, I never got into being in the rodeo, but I certainly got into entering produce at the fair out of my garden and being proud of it and meeting the old-timers that were entering produce and, you know, getting to know people. And it's worked out nicely for those of us that have made it.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to add that I didn't ask you about but you think is important?
Let me think. I think the Back to the Land movement, when it's written, is going to be a very, you know, when the history books are closed on it, it's going to be an interesting sidelight, but I think it is going to have lasting effects. I mean, obviously, the majority of people couldn't live their lives the way that I want to live my life. There just are too many people and not enough land to be able to do it that way. But I think that the ethic and the morality that we embraced and the humanistic way of looking at things is going to have an influence in the future. At least I hope so, because the future doesn't look as bright right now as it might have a few years ago to a lot of us. Oh my God. You know, there's marches today. There's marches today, and hope, which I actually thought about going to some marches, because something needs to be done if we're going to think about the present, because the country is not moving. We were very optimistic. Now I'm not so optimistic as I was, but on the other hand, it is true that the younger people, they're still having babies, which takes a pretty high degree of optimism to want to bring children forth into the world as it is today. So at least we've instilled some sort of positive attitude and optimism in these kids.
Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.